interesting. Yeah.
Thank you.
Right. Good evening, everybody. Good evening. Settle down, because obviously, appropriately, we're in a rush tonight. And I think tonight's question, racing to destruction, perhaps even more resonant after the events across the water in America recently as well. Robert's going to touch upon that. Robert Colville is somebody who embodies a career in a rush. He's somebody who has worked at The Telegraph, The Daily Telegraph, one of our oldest and most esteemed newspapers in the UK. He's also worked at BuzzFeed, which is one of obviously our more recently established digital news platforms as well, and is currently also running a kind of commentary website called CapEx, which is worth checking out if you're interested in political and other commentary. Tonight, though, Robert's going to be talking about his new book, The Great Acceleration. So please welcome Robert Colville.
Thanks. So it won't have escaped your notice, as Charlie alluded to, that, you know, things with the media aren't really that great. These are the kind of headlines we're getting. Is the press to blame for Donald Trump? Is the press to blame for Donald Trump? Is the press to blame for Brexit? Is the press to blame for, you know, pretty much everything? There seems to be a feeling that the way we get information is kind of broken. And I like to argue that this is mostly down to this broader phenomenon of acceleration, which I talk about in my book, but which manifests itself really in the media to a far greater extent than almost anywhere else. So in my book, I sort of make the case that life is accelerating. One of the great examples of this is the crawl on CNN. When it was introduced, it felt like just the most exciting thing in the world. There was breaking news. There was a big banner on the bottom of the screen telling you that something was happening. And more recently, one of the executives there said that crawls are almost antiquated. They seem almost sluggish in comparison to how quickly a website loads or changes pages. Our bodies are so revved up now that the crawl itself feels almost stately. And we try to acknowledge that by cutting our cameras more quickly, by putting up more images. So in terms of the media, there's sort of three kinds of acceleration that I'd like to talk about. I'm sort of mostly talking about print journalism because that's where I've worked, but it kind of applies elsewhere. The first is the acceleration of news transmission. When I started out, you'd come into the office in the morning, you'd read the other papers, you'd have a think, you'd talk to each other, and it would all be about what you were going to do in the next day's edition, and you'd have a good few hours to do that. And if something happened in a faraway country, it might be a day, even 2 days, before you actually found out about it. Now, stories break in real time on Twitter. They can come from anywhere. I talk in my book about the execution of Saddam Hussein. You know, that leaked to the world via the fact that someone was filming it with a smartphone. And by the time that the next day's paper had gone to print with actually a pretty inaccurate version of what had happened, a video of the real event was all over the world. You know, news is coming from anywhere, but also news stories themselves are moving more quickly. You can sort of see the internet hive mind chewing through every possible angle at a story, digesting it and moving on to the next thing. The great example of this is with Donald Trump in the recent election. They did a study of what the main stories were in terms of political coverage in the US. And as you'd expect, most days it was Donald Trump. But what was really interesting was that it was never the same story about Donald Trump 2 days in a row. Even when he'd done something incredibly newsworthy, like say that people who had abortions should be punished or picked a fight with the Pope, by the next day the caravan would have moved on, which is one of the reasons why maybe he didn't get the scrutiny he deserved or needed, because, you know, he was just sort of driving down a motorway throwing grenades out of his car, and by the time each one had exploded, he was already a mile away priming the next tweet, which would sort of lead everyone to sort of lurch after that. So the next sort of type of acceleration, which is connected to this, is an acceleration of workload. I mean, it's a kind of world's smallest violin thing, but when I started, my first day on the Telegraph comment desk, I was taken out to lunch at 12 o'clock and came back into the office at 3 o'clock, after having 4 pints of beer and no food. And this wasn't an initiation ritual. This was literally just how things worked back then. I mean, that was an exaggerated example even then. But there's the sheer volume of news, the volume of stories that journalists have to cover is astronomically greater. A study in Cardiff University estimated that the workload of the average Fleet Street journalist has trebled since 1985. So obviously that means that you don't have as much time for each story. You don't have as much time to check, to make that extra call to stand up the story. You're more willing to just take things on trust because you need to do the next thing. There's a great quote from a New York Times reporter who was doing really great work in Zimbabwe, where he wasn't actually allowed to be. And when he was finally arrested, they said, are you okay? Is prison tough? And he said, look, anything is better than having to file 4 times a day for the website. That's a journalist joke there. So the third type of acceleration, which sort of is allied to all of these, is an acceleration in business models. It's not news to anyone that newspapers that things are fundamentally changing in terms of how people consume their news, how you can get people to pay for news. I mean, I could fill the entire length of this speech with discussing the many different ways that people have told us that this is the latest thing which is going to save news. You need to be mobile first. You need to be good on Google. You need to be good on Twitter. You need to be good on Facebook. You need to have your own app. You need to have your own newsletter. You need to have your own VR goggles. This briefly in 2006 was the highlight of the digital revolution. This was an idea called Telegraph PM, and what this was the idea that you'd have the morning newspaper, and then around 3 o'clock we would send you like a PDF of a newspaper, which you could print out on your office printer and read on the train and take home. And it was seriously put forward that this was going to save journalism. So we've just there's been this kind of utterly unending period of uncertainty. And all of this is down to acceleration. The most fundamental bit of that is that readers have shifted from buying newspapers because it's so much easier to get news on your phone or via your laptop. And it's also, there were also so many calls on your time. Back in the old days, if you wanted to get news or if you wanted to get entertainment, there weren't that many options. Now there's an infinite number of options. And allied to this the result of that has been a collapse in the business model which has sustained the news industry. Traditionally, I as an editor would be presenting you with a bundle of services. I would be presenting you with a bit of news, a bit of foreign news, a bit of commentary, weather forecast, horoscope, TV listings, weather, business, just good enough coverage of everything you might be interested in. And I would be sending out that to a captive audience, and advertisers would pay me for access to that audience. And today that doesn't work. If I'm interested in football, I might read the Telegraph or the Guardian, but I'm probably going to read the fan site of the website of the club that I'm really passionate about. If I'm interested in business, there's going to be 1,000 blogs, each of which have much deeper and richer knowledge of the topic than a sort of general interest reporter. So even if you can find these huge audiences online, which many newspapers can, you can't actually persuade them to pay for your content. You can't present them to your advertisers as a valuable proposition. And as a result, the digital economy, the newsroom economy, has collapsed. In America, the number of newsroom staff is down from 56,900 in 1990 to 32,900 more recently. In 2014 to 15, the total fell by another 10%. I mean, there is a hollowing out happening of news as an industry. And above all, the sort of the one thing I'd ask you to take away about how this is working is that a transformation in music, we've gone from having albums as the thing that people buy to singles. And similarly, in the media, we don't get bulletins or newspapers or magazines anymore so much. We get stories, we get individual stories, and they come at us via our newsfeed. So this is an experiment which the Washington Post did, which was to show you how differently things are covered, whether you have a Republican trending newsfeed or a Democrat trending one, and which is obviously itself a cause of polarization. And there's been a huge debate about this, and Mark Zuckerberg is making some incredibly unconvincing comments about it in the last couple of days. But what's more interesting is if you look at the sort of thing in the top left to tell you where that story has come from, it's really small. You can sort of only barely see it. There's not much. What you see in those pictures, in those items is the headline or the video. The headline and the video and the picture. You don't really see the fact that it's from the New York Times or Medium or CompleteBullshit.com. You know, it's all about the individual story. And this has, according to the conventional narrative, which I kind of buy into, sent our media and sent our public culture into hell in a handcart. So the idea is that the stuff which does best is the stuff which makes you click. Clickbait. The overriding imperative behind journalism now is to have something which catches your attention as you're scrolling through this newsfeed. And similarly, anything which can be turned into content and put out onto this newsfeed is. So let me give you an example of how this works. In July last year, my wife and I were sitting together, and she was looking at a website called Mumsnet. And she found on there that some people were saying, someone had asked the question, is Jeremy Corbyn sexy? It's a bit strange, but I can't help finding him slightly attractive. I think the exact quote was, in a world-weary old sea dog kind of way. And most people underneath said, no, he's not sexy. What are you talking about? Someone said, not so much keen on Jeremy Corbyn, but that Michael Gove. And somebody else said, you know, Jeremy Corbyn was sexy. If you half fancied Albus Dumbledore, Jeremy Corbyn is probably up your street. I mean, so, but there were like, you know, 8 or 9 people on this thread. And I tweeted this link to a friend of mine at BuzzFeed who had been the one to discover the Miller fandom, which, if you remember, if you were in the UK for that, the election was this group of teenage girls who had semi-ironically and then actually not ironically at all decided that Ed Miliband was really, really sexy. And that, in turn, became a story. So between my wife and I noticing this thing and lunchtime, this happened. I mean, pretty much every news organization in the country, with the actual exception of BuzzFeed, who had a bit more class, had done their own story about how Jeremy Corbyn as a sex symbol was sweeping the internet. Jeremy Corbyn, at his next press conference, was asked how he felt about being a sex symbol. And even today, if you Google sexy Jeremy Corbyn, as I just did, you get stories about 19 Jeremy Corbyn photoshops guaranteed to get you hot under the collar. So yeah, that was me, apparently. So there's this kind of frenzied search for content, and it doesn't really seem to matter whether it's true. There's also a tendency towards gigantism, for everyone to make something the biggest story. So you probably remember this. Yeah. This was the story which. This was my first week at BuzzFeed. We got this story and a story about a jihadist and had to sort of split our newsroom in two, which was a slightly weird experience. But so 37 million hits for that story, which is pretty amazing. But again, what you sort of didn't really notice was all this, which is the other stories that we threw ourselves into producing, because as soon as something starts getting traffic, everyone leaps on it. When I was at The Telegraph, I actually think we did quite a lot to create UKIP as a political force, because we had on our blogs, we kept on noticing that blogs about UKIP would get traffic, so we did more blogs about UKIP, and they got more traffic, so we did more blogs about UKIP, and before you knew it, suddenly everyone was talking about the fact that everyone was talking about UKIP. There's this weird sort of reinforcement thing that happens. At its worst, this leads to a kind of thing where news isn't something that matters, it's just what gets you clicks. So this is the Balloon Boy story. Again, you may remember it, a boy was trapped in a helium balloon, and he was floating helplessly in the skies above Colorado. No, he bloody wasn't. He was at home in the attic having a good laugh with his dad. But again, you know, there was live coverage on CNN for pretty much an entire afternoon. This is another example. A zookeeper dressed in a gorilla suit got shot with a tranquilizer dart. And I've used this from Time just to show that this is not just kind of clickbait. Everyone is doing this. And if you see at the bottom there, this thing called the dodo, just Time has just grabbed it from somewhere else. The sort of imperative, once a story has got going, there's absolutely no margin in being the ones who go, I don't think this is really a story. It's all, you know, you put it up quickly, you get the hits. And actually, the reason I chose the zookeeper thing is that a colleague of mine at The Telegraph did actually check this. He was the one person on the entire planet who rang the zoo concerned and said, has someone actually been shot? And they said, no, someone was shot with a tranquilizer rifle. He was not wearing a gorilla suit. But that's the, you know, that correct story got about a hundredth of the hits of all of this stuff. So, you know, this is obviously an ecosystem that's pretty vulnerable to manipulation. If you want to be quite scared about this stuff, there's a book called Trust Me, I'm a Liar, Trust Me, I'm Lying, by a guy called Ryan Holiday, who was marketing director of American Apparel. And what he specialized in was planting completely outrageous stories about his company and the knowledge that it would get traffic. Or planting stories with quite small blogs, knowing that they were interesting enough that they'd get passed up the food chain and that no one would really bother to go back and check the original source. So as an exercise, he signed up to a site called Help a Reporter Out, where you can claim to be an expert in various things. And he said, in fewer than 4 months, I was a long-suffering insomniac on ABC News, a victim of germ warfare on MSNBC, a witness to an inter-office romance on CBS, a reluctant stock market investor on Reuters, and a vinyl record enthusiast in the New York Times. I've never owned a vinyl record. In fact, I didn't know what LPs stood for until I read about it in the article I was quoted in. So there's obviously a lot of things going wrong in this accelerated news environment. But in many ways, what we've got is a crisis of production rather than consumption. It's really bad to be trying to make money from producing news, but it's amazingly good to be someone sitting there who's looking for news to consume. And there's this weird thing that we are getting more trashy news than ever, absolutely, but we're also getting more really good stories. So I'm going to just show you a few more really trashy stories. From the UK tabloids. Man in China apparently ended up riddled with tapeworm parasites after eating too much sashimi. The reason I'm showing these stories is that all four of them come from the same place, a place called Central European News, which is a news agency which sort of specializes in creating wild and wacky stories about things happening in foreign places. And when I was at BuzzFeed, we ran an investigation into this, which showed that essentially they were making it all up. And that story got a really quite significant amount of traffic. It also got us sued for $11 million, which we're waiting to see what happens on that one. Likewise, we did a story about, they ran a story about a drunken Polish Santa Claus crashing his sleigh. We went back and talked to the people who were involved in this quite horrific accident. And it got, everyone was really, really interested in it and wanted to find out about it. There's a thing in the UK called the Paul Foote Award, which is for the best piece of investigative journalism. And I've been along to the shortlist ceremony, and there are really fantastic pieces there. You know, there is not less investigative journalism being done now than before. If anything, there's actually more. So what I think is happening, and what I argue in the book, is that there's a polarization happening between fast and slow, but also between sort of trashy and high quality. So if you look at the curve, the maps of which news stories people read, what you find is that people really like really short stories, and they really like really long stories. BuzzFeed found that stories of 3,000 words or more are shared 4 times more than average. It's not just about length, it's about quality. If you're in this environment where you have every single story in the world coming at you, you have every single news option, the things which stand out and which cut through are going to be the ones which are either really grabby or really good. And the dynamic of social news, the fact that we're reading things that other people have recommended, means that the best ones do so much better than the second best. That you really do get this which actually incentivizes you to produce good stories. Apologies for focusing on BuzzFeed, but this is a story probably the story I'm proudest of, which is, I urge you to all go online and read it, because it's this amazing story of someone who fell in head over heels with a girl who was, quite obviously fake, and he actually rejected a real person for this girlfriend who just kept on having excuses for why she couldn't meet up, and kept on putting her mother on the phone or her best friend. There was it was this really elaborate sort of con game. And if you look at that, it has had 2 million 2 million people have read that story, have read this amazingly in-depth, moving, beautifully produced, I say to myself, piece of journalism. And you can sort of find that all over the shop. If you look at the most read things, there's going to be the sort of really silly stuff, but there's also going to be the really really good pieces. So if you look at, so this has all sorts of implications, this sort of, this change in how we consume news. What, for example, it's kind of death to the traditional newspaper model, because newspapers rely on what I call the mushy middle, stories which are there to fill space but don't actually, but you never want to read them on their own. It's okay to read them if you're kind of just scrolling through pages and you sort of feel that you're getting a pretty good summary of what the world is about that day. But if you're kind of, if you're just going to read the individual pieces you care most about, then that's, you know, no one's going to look at them. And I mean, so one of, for the book, there's a whole chapter on politics as well, and the acceleration of the news agenda is having a huge impact on politics and the sort of the pressures politicians are under and the their ability to get things done. And one of the people I talked to in Downing Street was complaining that you know, that newspapers don't report the facts anymore, because by the time they've made their announcement or the minister's made the speech or whatever's happened, by the time the newspaper comes out, the story's moved on. So what the newspaper does in order to freshen it up and make people feel that they're not getting stale news is to put a bit more attitude into it. And I think this actually, so we've seen a whole thing recently here in the UK with, you know, judges versus the people, this whole people sort of complaining about the tabloid press going too far. I think in many ways the dynamic behind that is because they, you know, is that kind of that attempt to get attention, that attempt to move, to have us, you know, it's more important to have an opinion on the story than to just report it straight. But there's another sort of version of that, which is to say, okay, if people aren't going to read a straight take on the news the next day, then maybe they're going to read an analysis piece on it. Maybe they want to know actually kind of what this really means more deeply. So one of the most exciting, interesting phenomenon for me over the last 10 years or so is the fact that in the UK, even as newspaper sales have just drifted downwards, and sometimes not even drifted downwards, just plummeted downwards, the sales of magazines, the sales of things like The Spectator, The New Statesman, The Economist, Private Eye, Prospect, all of them have been going steadily up, because people still, you know, in this world polarized between fast and slow, people want to get the fast hit, but then they want to have the slow experience of reading something really good which tells them what it means. I mean, it can't be coincidence that literally all of these current affairs magazines are having the best sales that they've had in years. And there's sort of similarly encouraging things that if you, in a world where, you know, the speed of the news agenda these days is enormous. So that Jeremy Corbyn story I talked about was a classic example. Someone has it, within 10 minutes, everyone else has it. So you could say that then there's no sort of premium on being the fastest. So what you have to do is to be the best. It's to make your story stand out, because it's the one which has the extra quotes or the best picture, or what have you, or makes the extra call. So there are various other features of this sort of news economy which are sort of reassuring, if not, they don't wholly make up for all the things that are broken about it. So it's much more democratic. When I was doing work experience, I got a place at the Times for a week. This is back in the 1990s, and I went to sat sitting on their editorial conference, and one of the stories on the news agenda was the fact that the rankings had come out for the different Oxford colleges. And that conference literally stopped for 20 minutes while everyone tried to find out where their old college had come. Now, obviously, there's still a lot of elitism. You know, the media is still dominated by people like me, who are the product of private schools and, you know, white faces and all the rest of it. But at the same time, there's a real sort of meritocracy. You know, things like Twitter. You know, there's a guy called Elliot Higgins, who is a blogger from Leicester. He scooped the world on Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons. He has made himself, just by using the internet, the global authority on the atrocities that the regime is committing. And, you know, it's his sort of stories are sort of incredibly inspiring. And similarly, a guy at the Max Planck Institute, he sort of wanted to check what sources we gravitate towards on the internet. And he looked at 54 million Twitter accounts. And what he found was that the accounts we tend to trust are the ones which are generally expert and authoritative, the ones that give us a sort of steady diet of links and news on the topics that they're really, really good on. The filter bubble stuff, I'll just sort of talk about quickly. You know, it is obviously The fact that there is no mainstream anymore, the fact that there is no settled narrative of events, the fact that we all get our own, we all choose our own news, and it tends to be the news that reinforces the prejudices we already have. That's not obviously not a good thing. Actually, the interesting thing there is it's not actually the news itself which is the problem there. What happens is that it's our existing friendship groups. It's the fact that we tend to cluster with people who are like ourselves and talk to people like ourselves. Effectively, the internet is now starting to mirror the way that our daily lives work. You know, that's a big problem. But I think, as a sort of wrapping up thing, I think what I'd say is that we are still in for another decade or more of tumultuous change in how we produce news and how we consume news. I mean, one of the sort of when the New York Times did a report on you know how it can survive in a digital age, it sort of said, you know, we deliberately haven't called this a kind of a revolution. We haven't called it a sort of project, because project implies that there's some sort of ending, and there's not. It's just a sort of permanent process of change that we have adapt to as the new technology comes along, as the new technique, as the new audience comes. You know, so the same people who are frantically scrambling to build up their Twitter, their number of Twitter followers or the size of their Facebook feeds, are now frantically scrambling to work out what the hell Snapchat is, or what the hell WhatsApp is, and I don't think they're having much success. You know, but as communication gets more immediate, there are huge challenges, and huge changes. You know, you could argue on the one hand that the role of the editor is dead. You could argue that in a world where we consume news story by story, people like me who sit there and say that this is our output as a website are probably sort of slightly antiquated. Or you could say that actually there's never been a greater need for editing, that you know the process of curating, of filtering through all this stuff that's happening is a growth market, whether it's done by algorithms or whether it's done by people. So my sort of overall message is that, you know, we are in a sort of whirligig. All you have to do is just click your Twitter feed to see the pace at which the world is moving and to sort of see that there's a sort of feeling of sort of chaos and instability around the world. But at the same time, I sort of come back to that point that we don't have to race to destruction if we don't want to. That there is more, whatever you're interested in the world, there is more really good stuff out there than there ever has been. There are more accurate articles, there are more passionate articles telling you what you need to know than there ever have been. It's just a question of finding the time or finding the courage to go and look for them. So, thank you very much.
Do you have a seat?
Yeah. But, and finally, there's my book. So please buy it.
I was going to ask you particularly, you've looked at it from a very journalism-centric way to start with, and then you've talked about politics as well. How much do you think that life more generally is accelerating for people? Or do you think it's a kind of media illusion that the news is spinning faster, but somehow...
No, I definitely think life as a whole is speeding up. I mean, so even in the most basic metric, the speed with which we walk down the street, or the speed with which we talk to each other, our patience, the amount of time we're willing to wait for a web page to load, the fact that we get annoyed by, you know, by tiny irritations. I mean, the example I always give is when you're paying with a credit card. When I first came across contactless payment, I thought it was just this most magical and slightly sort of spooky thing, the idea that I would put my card on this device and money would automatically be sucked out of my account. And I was really quite nervous about it. And now, if I come across somewhere that doesn't have contactless payment, I'm just like, what the hell is this? You expect me to sit there for seconds and type in a bloody number? You know, it's our expectations just get faster and faster. And I think that's partly due to this, the amount of information that's coming at us, not primarily in terms of the media, but just things like email or TV. Or, you know, we are surrounded now by more information than ever.
But not just information, I suppose. It's also, well, you just talked about paying for things. I mean, there's a kind of Deliveroo culture as well, the kind of just-in-time production, but also consumption. Yeah. So I wonder how far, you know, that extends beyond just pizzas, doesn't it?
Yeah, okay, well, completely. Although pizzas actually is a really good example. Domino's is now having the most successful years it's ever had. It's like a darling of the stock market because they've really tried to harness this idea that we don't want any friction in our lives. We want the sort of the gap from impulse to impulse being satisfied to be as short as possible. So what Domino's have done is that they've set up a system where you can now sort of tweet at them or message them with text. You can just text them with a pizza emoji, and if it's already set up, then in 20 minutes' time, a pizza will arrive at your door, which is your usual.
I guess artificial intelligence means that they'll even be able to spot it before you post the emoji that you should be kind of.
So this is one of the fascinating things. I mean, when Apple came up with the Apple Watch, one of the ideas for it was to try to filter the world for us. That we were getting so many notifications on our phone, we were getting so much stuff flashing up that we were just being overwhelmed. So you would have this phone which just gave you the really important stuff. So it would give you a call from your mum, not, you know, a spam email from someone trying to sell you Viagra drugs. The problem with all of this, though, is that at the moment algorithms are just smart enough to be terrifyingly dumb. I mean, I'm sure we've all had sort of that experience of just going no Facebook, no Google, no Twitter. That's a really stupid thing for you to have done. And I think it's going to take a while before they sort of reach that level where they can actually help our lives rather than just making us feel bloody annoyed that they're getting in the way.
Yeah. You slightly dodged the if you like, more philosophical bit about, you know, is the internet making us stupid kind of thing, or is Google making us stupid bit, which is the conventional wisdom would be that if we are accelerating our lives, then even if it's not making you stupid, what's the book about thinking slow and thinking fast? Who's the book?
Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast.
Yeah. So even if it's not thinking dumber, if you're thinking quicker, you're definitely thinking differently, aren't you? So we're moving to a more instinctive, reactive, rather than thoughtful.
I think that is true to an extent. The problem I have with that is, I mean, there are many, many books you can get which argue that. The problem is that people have been arguing that for several hundred years. Every single time a new technology comes along, especially a new media technology, it's viewed as the work of the devil. So the telegraph, which was the kind of revolutionary technology of the 19th century, the second message sent on it is Morse saying to his mate, "Have you got any news?" You know, that's what we. And then you get people going, "Oh my God, people are using it for gossiping and gambling and all sorts of things." You know, when magazines come along, people complain that people are sitting at home of an evening all reading individual magazines rather than having stimulating conversations about, you know, the day's events as they used to do in the good old days. You know, so there's this sort of very long track record of people being panicked about the changes technology is making, and a very long track record of them being proved wrong. So obviously, in terms of what the internet's doing to our brains, yes, there are sort of reasons to be concerned, but I think it's more about having self-discipline that, you know, that the signs are from it's still really quite early to tell because we haven't been using these things for long enough for it to show up in the data, but the signs are that, you know, yes, the internet does retrain your brain, but you can also retrain it. You know, you can, if you want to start reading Proust again, it doesn't take that long to teach yourself to read Proust again.
Or there's probably a Proust account on Twitter that you could probably follow, and it'll just do La Recherche de Tom Perdu in 140 characters a go. I think we lost you at that point. So, have we got any questions from anybody on the floor? Any comments about people in your accelerated lives? Thank you. Right in the middle there. Sorry, we've got the microphones, haven't we?
Hi. Thanks for your intervention. I think it's a great theory, and it applies, and it highlights the need for someone of some authority, if not everyone's ability to be educated, and try and avoid this blurring between fact and fake. But according to you, what's the importance also of distinguishing between commercially driven articles, for example, and normal articles that aren't sponsored? And I think BuzzFeed is really at the heart of that, you know, the need to distinguish between what is actually someone's opinion or what is actually an opinion that's paid for or that, you know, is actually serving someone's greater interest. What's your point on that?
Yes, I mean, this comes down back to the idea of the feed, that, you know, that it's almost impossible to spot when something is a sponsored post and something isn't. And obviously, having the right rules in place about when about people needing to signify in some fashion is very important on that. And also, sort of, you know, greater education. I mean, the number, you know, there are some mildly horrifying ideas about people not knowing how Google works and not knowing how, you know, the things which pop up above and to the right are actually paid for, and all of those kind of things. But what this is coming from is kind of this what I was talking about before, which is this desperate attempt to try to find a way to make news pay. And I'm sort of worried about people confusing ads for real stuff, but I'm less worried about that than I am about the whole kind of news media going away because no one can afford to find a revenue model. So it might be a compromised revenue model, but it looks like one of the best ones we've got. As long as there is a sort of still that kind of cast iron division between the news guys and the advertising guys, which in many cases there is, and in some cases there isn't. And I think it's the ones where it isn't that we should be a bit more worried about.
And what about very quickly, just on the Facebook thing, you said you were a bit sceptical about calls for them to do more?
In terms of?
Clearing up the sort of fake news thing, you know, that...
No, I think Facebook should definitely do more in terms of fake news, because, you know, the stuff that was going around before the election was very clearly completely fraudulent. You know, there was this village in Macedonia where they were all just setting up, you know, DonaldIsGreat.com and just, you know, writing stories about how Clinton had just been arrested and watching as the traffic came through and they got the ad revenue off the back of it. You know, that sort of type of stuff is really bad. I mean, so what I suggested this week as a sort of thought experiment was maybe that, you know, in that red and blue feed, it shouldn't be a sort of fairness doctrine thing where you have to get shown one Democrat piece for every Republican piece, but maybe in sort of smaller as a sort of badge thing under the end of the piece, it could say, hey, there are some people who disagree with this, and here are their viewpoints. But Facebook's an interesting one more generally, in that what people sort of don't appreciate is that it's becoming a pay-to-play space. In the old days, Facebook used to be about just how many people you could attract to your page, and you know, your posts could go absolutely massive. And in order for Facebook to make money, what they've done is not capped how well your posts can do, but there's a kind of, as a publisher, you know, we're constantly being told, hey, this post of yours is doing quite well. You could reach loads more people, though, if you just gave us, like, £3 or £4. So there's a kind of, people don't appreciate the sort of, the distortions that are in play in terms of what you see.
Yeah, it's not just a neutral platform. Sorry, you wanted to...
Thank you for stopping by. So, this is a completely biased question, but I just, when you think about sort of reputation of news sources and you have the dual feed, how do you reconcile when on the red feed you see sources like Constitution.com or like, you know, Red Patriot versus on the blue side, Washington Post and the New York Times, which, although they are accused of being more liberal, they are also one of the main, you know, sort of reputable news sources.
Yeah. Well, they probably shouldn't be in the blue feed. They should probably be in the feed down the middle, which goes, this is actually what the truth is. But there are probably not that many people, sadly, who are. I mean, so one of the things which is causing this is a really well known phenomenon to social scientists, which is that when you're in a group, that group tends to get more extreme. So if you formed a Jeremy Corbyn fan club, say, you might go in thinking, I quite like Jeremy Corbyn. I'll sign up to this and see what it goes. And you would perceive other people as being much more keen on Jeremy Corbyn than you were, because you couldn't see what they were doing with the other 99% of their lives. You just see them going, I quite like Jeremy Corbyn. And then gradually, inexorably, that group would sort of move off into the, you know, it would sort of reinforce each other as, you know, people just wanted to be liked, wanted to conform, wanted that. The group identity would come to focus around Corbyn, and before you knew it, everyone would be like really keen on Jeremy Corbyn. And you can still see exactly this happening with all kinds of news sources. So, which doesn't answer your question at all. In fact, it sort of suggests that things are going to get worse. But I think it's and what really has disappointed me after the election is the way that Mark Zuckerberg has been framing his answer completely around fake news as opposed to the news stream we see. Because fake news is an easy problem, and it's a kind of actually not that controversial one. Whereas, you know, changing what we see in the newsfeed is something which strikes at the heart of Facebook's business model, which is to capture as much of your attention as it can by giving you exactly what you want. But getting exactly what we want isn't necessarily the best thing for us.
Although I find that very problematic. I don't know how people feel, but, I mean, generally speaking, Facebook will give you stuff according to what you've done in the past. And the idea of me sitting here reading The Guardian and you coming along and saying, hang on, start reading the Telegraph.
Exactly.
You better read the Telegraph for a bit, Charlie, because, you know, you've been reading the Liberal Guardian for too long. And also, why split it into two? You know, we just had an election where you've had Trump and then an array of other Republicans and Sanders and Clinton who probably hate each other more than they hate Trump. So how many feeds is that? And I just worry about the idea of Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, well, so this is why, I mean, Zuckerberg is
trying
just
to do good for me.
He is very, very reluctant and paranoid, and if nothing else, he just hates the idea of people blaming him for anything. He wants this theory to be that Facebook is a completely neutral space, and the algorithm is sort of neutral and omnipotent, and that's how it all works. So, you know, I completely understand the thinking there.
Yeah. Anybody else? Sorry, over there.
Hey, thanks very much for coming through. Late last week, a group of academics, including some in our department, wrote a letter that was published in The Guardian calling on Facebook and Google to pay a levy that would cross-subsidize new media and specifically public interest media. Do you think that's a realistic call? Do you think that's possibly a way out of the crisis facing public interest media?
I don't really know. I mean, part of this problem is that, you know, the internet tends towards monopoly. That, you know, as soon as enough people are using Facebook, everyone sort of ends up on Facebook. Everyone sort of ends up on Google. So you end up with these enormously powerful actors, which have, you know, basically monopolized all of the ad revenue. But then you sort of have this question of how you would share that out. And it kind of goes back to Charlie's point. Do you need someone sitting there deciding what public interest is, and does that then form part of a cartel? Because if you share it out in terms of clicks, well, then you're going to get the same problem you've had before, only even more so. Maybe you do it in terms of attention, so you pay attention. You focus on how much of these pieces people are actually reading. I mean, one of the sort of encouraging things about this, about the social news, is that, you know, the headline leads you to click on it. But you only share something if you actually like it, which is a sort of incentive towards quality. So I haven't thought in depth about this idea. I'm sort of instinctively skeptical of that kind of thing. But it's Facebook and Google have, you know, classified advertising was what kept newspapers going, and it's been taken away. I mean, the alternative is obviously to find ways of communicating with readers and users which aren't Facebook or Google. I think this is why people are investing quite significantly now in email newsletters, having sort of rediscovered the fact that not having to rely on Mark Zuckerberg to talk to your readership is probably quite a good idea.
Yeah, I think it's a really difficult one. I didn't sign that letter for that reason.
So Facebook's defense on this would be, on all of this, would be that they did a study and they found that their algorithm wasn't showing you the news that you wouldn't already have got, but that's kind of, the reason is that, you know, the problem is your friends. It's not, in an odd way. It's not, you know, the problem is the sort of what I was talking about before, the sort of conformism, the fact that we all tend to like and talk to people who agree with us, and then Facebook is just sort of exactly replicating that. So it's a, you know, it's quite a. There's always going to be an incentive towards giving people what they want, and producing news which does that, and that's always going to be rewarded financially. So. How you make people eat, I mean, it's the sort of all this question: how you make people eat their vegetables. The answer in Fleet Street always used to be that no one would read the foreign pages, but they were quite glad they were there. But there was this sort of public service thing. It's like having the news at 10. You might not watch it, but you like the idea that these things are there, and if you are interested in them, you can check them out. And I mean, just one thing as well is we should not overestimate how ill-informed people were back in the day. I mean, we shouldn't sort of think that there was this golden age when everyone knew, was completely engaged and completely informed, and it's only in our modern dumbed-down era that things like Donald Trump can happen. I mean, you know, people have been not caring about politics and spouting ignorant and racist opinions for a very long time.
Yeah, indeed. Go ahead. Hiya.
A lot of development as well as journalism was built on the notion from Enlightenment, basically, that human being tries to find the cause of the reasons, and he wants to know the truth, and he would act according to, like, more or less, like, you know, like, so the real reasonable conditions. And so I mean, that's like a basis of everything, including, yeah, like, development, you know, like we think, oh, there's a problem because people are not as educated, they don't know as much. If we would provide them knowledge, technology, you know, they would learn, they would develop, etc., etc. But like now, the case was like certain, well, Brexit and Trump kind of showing that sometimes even with possibility to get the information, technology, you still kind of choose not to go to like the what is like real, but like you just choose to stick with what you feel comfortable, you know, like. It doesn't matter what it really is, but I like it, you know. So you kind of open your way to this negative side. Doesn't it kind of, you know, like, strike to the very basis of whole development, enlightenment? It's like, looks, because I mean, it draws some really dark future for me. Like, people would literally choose wrong news. They would just literally, you know, like the wrong things just because they like it, you know, even if it's like potato bullshit. And even if it's racist, maybe even special if it's racist.
So there's always that thing, you know, I think what we've seen recently is that emotion is just as powerful, if not more powerful than reason. And back to Charlie's point on thinking fast and slow, in a sort of faster age, maybe, you know, people sort of bow to their faster instincts. That said, I think it's possible to overplay this whole thing as a collapse of reason and logic. I mean, you know, people in London might not have voted for Brexit, but there were a lot of people who did vote for Brexit out of, you know, entirely rational, and, you know, who thought about it for quite a while and reached their decision. I mean, one of the striking findings from the exit poll in the States was that, you know, people that they didn't think Donald Trump was qualified to be president. The people who voted for him didn't think he had the temperament to lead the country. They just didn't care, because they made the, for them, rational judgment that their lives were shit enough already and that they couldn't exactly get worse. And it's in the same in Brexit. The alliance was between the people who'd already paid off their mortgages, so didn't have to worry about what happened to the economy, and the people who just really didn't feel it could get any worse and wanted to give London a kicking. And that might not that would have been sort of, that might have been long-term rational, but it wasn't wholly irrational either.
But do you accept that partly because of the sort of complexity, one of the problems with the fake news is not that it's fake per se, but it means that you then don't doubt anything, that you think, you then suspect everything, and therefore you're less confident about the idea of knowing something.
Yeah, so the tendency over the last 30, 40 years, as the world has accelerated, actually, is a sort of complete erosion of our trust in hierarchies, in any sort of established systems which restrain, like things like, you know, churches, family, state, you know, priests, you know, all the people who sort of told you can't do this thing because it's not good for you. We kind of go, actually, we all want to live our own lives. And one of the sort of Vladimir Putin is really interested on this. His propaganda is not designed to tell people that this is the truth and the West is lying to you. It's designed to throw up chaff. It's designed to sort of introduce enough reasonable doubt about, you know, well, we don't really know what happened to that plane that we shot down. Well, we don't really know what was happening in Ukraine when we invaded it. You know, we don't really know what was happening in Crimea when we invaded it. You know, the goal is to sort of foster the sense that the world is a place in which there is no absolute truth, no one can really be trusted, so it's all too boring to care about, and we might as well just trust the guy in charge. And I think that's a real danger that's what happens with all the sort of Trumpism stuff, because Trump very, very successfully managed to convince a lot of people that what was coming out of the mainstream media, I mean, even that phrase is like kind of derogatory. Mm. What was coming out of the MSM could not be trusted, when actually, you know, most, you know, yes, obviously journalists have their biases and they miss all sorts of things, but, you know, there is a real professional pride in trying to get the story right, which there simply isn't in some of the sort of wackier stuff to the fringes on either side.
Okay. We've accelerated to the end of our hour. Robert, I'm very grateful. Thanks very much.
Yes.
attack it and right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe like maybe on, attack it.
I think
one.
Maybe on this one because it wouldn't fit.
We've stuck it on there before. You can just stick it on top.
Do you know what
as
I mean?
Long as
this like sticks out then.
Okay. Well, we have a banner back here then. If that one's down there and then banner up here.
Yeah.
And then maybe the other banner outside or over there. Which is it too much of an overkill if we have a banner on both sides?
So what do we usually?
Are they the same banner?
They're the same
yeah,
banner.
Maybe that's a
yeah. So should we just leave
one outside?
One outside
and know
yeah,
are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then reserve signs.
Do you want them front row?
Ooh, which is the best?
Yeah, we usually tend to tend to do front row,
okay.
Always starting from
yeah.
Here, that
okay.
Way.
Start rearranging the rows.
Yeah.
You can see those last three are all wrong.
And then there's quite a lot of rubbish here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should I put this one?
Yeah.
Whichever way it looks best, really. What's your?
Is the speaker going to speak from the lectern, or is it going to be? Because they'll probably block it, so it might be better to have it like. Maybe even on that side.
Okay.
How many speakers?
Just one.
Yeah, so there'll just be a speaker
guy.
In a chair, so
yeah.
It might be better to put it like.
Okay.
Just because if the speaker's here and people are taking pictures, it'll block the logo. So.
Okay. I just want something at the lectern so that when he talks and I take a photo, it's quite, you know, so.
Right.
Because that
maybe
won't
just
be.
Put it here, then?
Sure. Yeah?
So at least it's not directly behind.
Okay.
Or if there's going to be slides.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking that, like, what's the speaking here?
You've
always
your blocking projector.
That's okay. If it's
okay.
Blocking the logo, yeah. It's fine. Is the bottle one of yours? Or
oh, that's my side.
Okay, so just wondering if I should move it away or leave it there. Noah, we only need 14. I think there's 15 over there, so one is not needed. these chairs are completely...
Oh, yeah. They're completely mismatched.
Yeah. Kind of terrible.
Yeah, which one do
you want? Is there anything... I mean, probably we should get rid of this one because it's so blue.
Yeah. Oh, there might be another one. Oh, we don't have a key. I'm going to go see if the cupboard up... I'll cover up chairs open. There's a black one right here, set there, I think.
Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 1, 2. Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2, 1, 2. Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2.
If it is, I mean, we'll just roll with these terrible, terrible seats.